This is a recording of the open meeting of the Federal Election Commission held on August 22, 2013. Should you have questions after listening to the recording, please call the FEC at 1-800-424-9530 or email us at info@fec.gov.
Of the Federal Election Commission for Thursday, August 22nd, 2013 will now come to order. I heard the pitter-patter of little feet in the hallway earlier today, and yesterday we had the pleasure of the vice chairman's little boy visiting us. It's always a pleasure to see people's children. I'm particularly wistful about that right now because this week I took my youngest child off to college. To my colleagues who have younger children, enjoy the noise and the pandemonium while you've got it. Believe me, you will miss it when it's gone. First item on the agenda is correction and approval of the minutes. Mr. Vice Chairman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I move to adopt agenda document number 13-32, minutes for the open session held on July 25th, 2013.
Thank you. The Vice Chairman has moved approval of agenda document number 13-32, the minutes for the open meeting of July 25th, 2013. Is there any discussion on the motion? All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Any opposed? And the motion carries 5-0. The next item on the agenda is draft advisory opinion 2013-04 from the Democratic Governors Association and Jobs and Opportunity. Commissioners anticipate having questions for Mr. Elias. Shall I invite him to the table?
Too early to tell.
Too early to tell.
I think we left the ball.
Okay.
Report on what we're going to do with this.
Well, I'm not sure I want it in my court. All right. Well, stay tuned, Mr. Elias. We may invite you to the table. I've been thinking about this a lot, and we had a lengthy discussion last time. And I appreciate the additional comments that were submitted. My problem is that I feel like the argument proves too much, because it seems to me that If Congress has to explicitly state that when it issues a provision that's relevant to a particular organization, that it also covers organizations that are controlled by that organization, organizations that are run by their own officers, then it just becomes too easy for anyone to get out of a restriction by just setting up a subsidiary and having their own officers run it in the interests of the parent organization. So I'm sure some people find this an easy question, but for me that second question is a difficult one. But I think I'm not going to shift from where I originally started out on this, which was to basically say no and no. But I'm not sure where anybody else is. Well, I'm sure where some people are, but I'm not sure where everybody else is on that. Mr. Vice Chairman.
It's in the same place I was last time. To address that directly, though, the statute, we're not talking about a vague statute that only sort of throws out general guidance. I mean, we're not the EPA that has sort of a general go and clean the air kind of statutory language. It's a rather complicated statutory scheme that under basic tenets of statutory construction, you have to read the document as a whole, and there are parts in the statute that do expressly talk about certain people being roped in to various restrictions under McCain-Feingold, whether it's agents or whether it's employees. You look at the sort of example, in the coordination context, we have a very specific rule about folks who work for someone, the time period that they could cleanse themselves, for lack of a better term, from a sort of coordination allegation. You have in the fundraising context, the agency is expressly there. But in the issue that we're talking about here, there is nothing in the statute that ropes in employees of the DGA or the RGA or any similar group starting their own thing. So it's not a question of, well, there's some vague language and we're not sure what it means. The language is quite specific in other places, and it's a rather basic canon of statutory construction that when it's specific in one part and not in another, or the absence of another, that tells you what it means. And it means that the answer is not up in the air. The answer here is clear. There's nothing that prohibits these folks from doing what they want to do. And really, it comes back to the fundamental premise of election law. This is not a law that says everything's prohibited unless the FEC grants permission. It's really the inverse. You are free to do what you want unless it's prohibited. And it is Congress that puts in place prohibitions. They did not put in the place a prohibition in this case. When one looks to the statute, they're just, to me, it's a pretty clear answer. The one thing I would like to do, though, I do want to ask Mr. Elias one question since he's here, because he may actually have be able to help me.
Come on down, Mr. Elias. I knew somebody was going to want to ask you something.
You filed some additional comments, which I thought were very helpful. So I guess two questions. I can't remember the statutory canon of construction that I'm referencing, but maybe being a more learned attorney than I am, since I've been on the bench for 5 years, perhaps...
There's Latin involved.
Yes, and I, being a former Catholic altar boy, not a former Catholic, but a former altar boy, I used to know the Latin Mass, so I usually pride myself in knowing Latin, but I, you know, exclusio and all that, I don't want to hot dog it and get it wrong. And two, setting aside trying to figure out where four votes would be, this whole argument we had last, this discussion we had last time about whether they're a separate entity under state law and all that, for my purposes as someone who reads the Act, and I've already stated how I read the Act, that's not really a particular consequence to me, because I see it as a much clearer answer. So if you could maybe flesh out those two points a little bit.
Sure.
That would help my thinking.
Sure. So let me address those in turn. With respect to the first, and this goes to your question and also the concern I think that the chair raised, I think if this tape could be played to Congress in 2002, they would be shocked. I mean, they'd be actually completely shocked. Because Congress never intended to federalize state campaign finance law. I mean, going back to the 1974 Act.
Well, not only that, they assured the world they weren't
not doing this. Yeah. I mean, this will be a radical step for the FEC to say that it is going to import agency, not in the core provisions of the Act where agency is explicitly spelled out, right? Agents of national party committees, agents of federal candidates, agents of federal office holders. But rather, it is going to import it into what is, after all, the organizations that I'm here representing today, they are not interested in federal elections. They are interested in state elections. And as a anti-circumvention measure itself, the provision we're talking about itself was an anti-circumvention measure. It was simply put in place to prevent federal candidates from controlling state caucus organizations. And now for the commission to say that we're going to ignore that balance. I mean, remember, at the time McCain-Feingold, it was already seen as a large step towards federalizing a lot of traditionally state activity because of the allocation, doing away with many of the allocations that state parties could have enjoyed under the previous law, and federalizing large chunks of what state parties did. But to then say that the commission is going to take what itself was a bit of a reach, was sort of on the line of permissible regulation, which was the regulation of purely state officials' activity, state candidate activity, and then put an anti-circumvention read not in the statute on top of that. I mean, that just isn't, I think that Congress, frankly, just, that is not at all what they had in mind. I think that this is now two steps. We are now marching two. We have the federal candidates in the federal elections, which is what we're trying to principally this agency's jurisdiction is concerned with, and then we have association of state office holders as an anti-circumvention to make sure that they don't circumvent their restrictions. Well, we've already presumably question number one. I'm not going to prevail on. So now we've moved from that to another organization, which is not an association of state office holders, that has overlapping staff with an association of state office holders. And now we're going to apply agency to that. And boy, that is just a very, very far afield, I think, from where Congress thought. And I'm not in Congress, but I think where Congress was at that
time. But the point I'm making, though, is I'm not relying on some subjective congressional intent of what Congress thought. I'm looking at the structure of the document, right? I mean, there's the plain language of the statute, and then there's legislative history. But there is this in-between zone where you look at structure of the document, and there are these statutory canons of construction that, the way I read the statute, come out all pointing the same direction, which is the direction you ultimately want. But I'm not even getting to what Congress had in mind or any of that. I'm asking specifically about how to read the law.
Right. I think the law, honestly, if this agency tried to enforce this provision against, first of all, I seriously doubt, in the cold light of day, I have a feeling Mr. Heckler would arrive in one door and Mr. Cheney would arrive in another door, because your counsel would tell you behind closed doors, if you tried to enforce this statute, you'd get the whole statute struck down. The statute is plain on its face, to your point, Mr. Vice Chair. The statute does not cover anything other than association of state office holders. And if you look at draft B, which is presumably the alternate that is at issue here, it doesn't cite anything that ties this statute to agents acting on behalf of, or agents not acting on behalf of, or entities established, financed, maintained, or controlled. There is nothing that moors the concepts of 441I, which affect national parties and state candidates, where those have direct application, and apply it to this provision, which does not. So I think you don't need to get beyond the plain language of the statute. I completely agree. My only point is that I am a little bit concerned that some of the comments may have suggested sort of this is atmospherically what we ought to care about. And honestly, I've never been in Congress, so I can only speak for what I observed from the outside. This is not at all what I think Congress thought they were doing with vis-a-vis state election officials and organizations that are not, in this case, even controlled by or have members of state election officials, and who have disavowed doing a PASO activity, even though they wouldn't be required to disavow that under the law, to give this commission kind of further comfort about what their focus is. Their focus is gubernatorial elections. Golly gee, to say it politely, what is the Federal Election Commission struggling with an organization that just wants to affect governor's elections?
Yeah, golly gee. So what you're addressing in part is those who love to invoke the spirit of McCain-Feingold. You hear this language time and time again. And what you're saying, this isn't even the spirit of McCain-Feingold. This is some ghost in the haunted house that only Scooby-Doo and Shaggy would find worth pursuing.
I am firmly on the spirit of McCain-Feingold. There is no question in my mind. There is no question. If you want the purpose and the spirit, of McCain-Feingold, McCain-Feingold was never intended. I supported McCain-Feingold. My law firm supported McCain-Feingold. My clients, who are federal officials, supported McCain-Feingold. McCain-Feingold was not an effort to federalize purely state election activity. It was an effort to federalize and regulate activity that affects federal elections and some mixed activity, some activity that was going to have a mixed purpose. But here you have an organization that is not covered by the already secondary anti-circumvention provision, and it would be just a big jump to now say that the spirit somehow captures that. I just don't think it does.
Interesting. It reminds me of something that when this happened, there were some of us, me, a couple others, who actually said this federalizes state and local politics. And I recall Senator McCain very publicly saying, no, the Republican lawyers are overstating this. That's not what this does. And I remember actually Congressman Shea is saying the same thing. So even the principal sponsors, at least on the Republican side, said, no, this doesn't federalize everything. Let me suspend reality for a minute, because that tends to happen here more often than not. So it's a comfort zone that I've learned to suspend reality, assume things that aren't true, and then play out the hypothetical. Let's assume you can somehow export an agency concept from one part of the statute to another part of the statute and sort of have the spirit of McCain-Feingold saying this just doesn't seem to be the sort of thing that we should let happen. Even with that concept of agency, that's limited. People can wear more than one hat. Now, what I don't understand is, even if you go down this road of this seems wrong, therefore it is wrong, why we presume that these folks are somehow now suspect simply because they work for the DGA? There's no factual record. There's no facts presented by you. It's your request, so you know the facts better than anyone in the room, which is going to be, I hope, my final question for you. I don't know of any facts that taint these folks or somehow make them suspect, or they want to start their own group. And it's easy to say, well, this is, you know, they're just trying to get around things. Well, they're not trying to get around things. They're trying to do things. They're trying to participate in politics. But I don't know of any facts that we can presume them to be guilty of something. Do you?
I don't, and we tried to be constructive based on the last hearing, when it seemed like there was a consensus or at least an opening for compromise, if we could provide language that would make clear that this would not simply be a pierce the corporate veil alter ego situation. We went, we did the research, we came back, we presented to you, I think, in neutral terms. If the general counsel found a different view of DC law than we did, it should speak up, but laid out what the standard is for something to be pierce the corporate veil or to be alter egos. We offered to put a footnote in that says that if we do those things, then we will have crossed the bridge that for which we don't get protection from the opinion. And I guess I had hoped that we were going to pick up at that point, but I don't know whether that's where the commission's thinking still is, or whether there are starker differences.
There's other examples in the law where people can wear more than one hat, right? You can, even under the statute, if you are a federal office holder running for state office, ordinarily you would be banned from raising certain money, but the law expressly says you can raise money legal under state law. I remember in the McCain-Feingold litigation, McConnell versus FEC, that even the national party chair, the idea of wearing more than one hat was something trumpeted by the government and the interveners as a way to save what could otherwise be an overbroad law. There are other examples out there. I mean, coordination rules is an example.
Right.
It seems to me the law, there's a number of examples where you simply don't presume that someone's tainted, and that's the end of the story.
No, in fact, I believe, and I can't remember if it was a MER or an AO, but I believe the commission approved the chief of staff of a sitting member of Congress in Montana as not being an agent of a federal office holder.
Freeburg, AO.
It was an AO.
Yeah. So he wanted to run the state party.
Is that right?
State party chair. And the commission said, okay. So a sitting member's chief of staff could be the state party chair. That was fine. And that's much closer to the McCain-Feingold text and spirit, wouldn't you agree, than your situation?
Look, there's no question. McCain-Feingold aimed to regulate state parties, and it aimed to put restrictions on federal office holders and federal candidates. There's no question about that. That was, in some sense, one of the core purposes of McCain-Feingold was to regulate state party activity. And indeed, this provision, I believe, had its mission at simply being a way of preventing that from being circumvented. The concern was that the state party provisions would be circumvented by federal candidates simply offloading those activities to organizations of state elected chairs. So you'd have, or state elected officials. So you'd have the state senator from Reno and the state senator from Las Vegas get together, form an association, and then it would be controlled by a federal officeholder, and you'd avoid the allocation rules. That's what this provision was aimed at. We have now, assuming I lose on question one, said, okay, that also applies to the governors, even though they're from multiple states. Fine. But now also an organization that is set up by two people who work for that association but who themselves are not governors. are not on the official staffs, by the way, of governors, are not on the campaign. You know, we're considerably further afield.
I feel like maybe we're talking past each other. I'm not looking for the spirit of McCain-Feingold out there in the atmosphere. I think I hear the statutory argument. I don't think it's quite as clear-cut as if indeed the statute were explicit and said, but this doesn't cover organizations established, financed, maintained, and controlled, or their agents or officers. That would be explicit. We wouldn't even be having this discussion. I do think that it's a little bit more ambiguous. I'm not discounting the statutory argument, but I do think it's a little bit more ambiguous. And it's my concern is that there's a restriction in the statute, and I don't think it's my job to decide whether that was on the edge of what Congress could permissibly have done or not. It's in the statute. It's been upheld. It's there. Whether Congress would have written any of these provisions had they known that the Supreme Court was going to issue Citizens United and there'd be all these super PACs out there, who knows? But that's not where we are. So my concern is solely on trying to give effect to a provision that is in the statute. I feel like, as I said, that maybe we're talking past each other, because it seems to me that in the request, you have actually posited, and tell me if I'm just getting this entirely wrong, that there would be involvement by the organization. I thought the request stated that, and these aren't two random employees, these are the two top officers of the DGA who would be the principals of Jobs and Opportunity. The group of persons that will decide how J&O spends its money will include DGA officers and other DGA employees. Other DGA employees are likely to play a role in the day-to-day operations of J&O. It's possible that DGA will provide funds to J&O. And then there was this sort of, I didn't know exactly what to make of this statement, that the actual state office holders would generally not play a role in how the funds were spent, although then there was the statement that, well, state law would, and I think, again, the term was generally preclude them, but not, you know, generally as in they're not going to do it, or generally as in they might do it, or if state law permits them to do it, they'll get more involved in the organization. That seemed a little bit fuzzy to me, but the way my colleague was describing it, it sounded like, well, two random employees of an organization that was an association of state office holders wanted to go off and do their own thing. That perhaps in combination with other folks who have no relation at all to the DGA. That wasn't the way I read the request. I read the request as two people who are the top officers of the DGA, in light of the fact that the DGA can't do these things themselves. They're going to set up a separate organization, but it's going to be very much informed by their concurrent role as officers of DGA. Now, maybe I'm just, and that's where my problem comes from, because the two organizations seem to me, whether they are, you know, legally set up as separate organizations or not, it still seems to me that they are somewhat intertwined. And maybe that's not what's happening. So that's one concern. And another concern is that while you say they're not going to run PASO ads, your legal argument, as I think you just stated, would in fact permit them to run PASO ads. So if we were to say, you know, based on this statutory argument that officers of an association of state office holders can set up its own organization and they're not subject to 441I, what would preclude another organization from springing up that indeed would be running PASO ads that are about federal candidates?
Well, nothing would prevent that group from setting up, which is why we have so many super PACs, because in fact, thousands of those groups set themselves up right now. This is why this is such, from my perspective, such a odd concern. There is already a mechanism to set up an organization that runs PASO ads, in fact, express advocacy ads that advocate the election and defeat of clearly identified federal candidates for office. There are myriads of them. I've sought advisory opinions on behalf of some of them. Stephen Colbert has sought advisory opinions on behalf of some of them.
Yeah, but he closed.
So the answer is, what would stop them? Someone else from setting up a group? Absolutely nothing. They set them up every day. And that's that. That's why I keep saying this is a very, very narrow question. This is really a question of whether or not the commission is going to take a provision that was aimed at preventing the circumvention of state party allocation rules. So there are no allocation rules for super PACs. Super PACs don't have to allocate. They just spend whatever money they spend. So you have to look at this through the prism of, what does this provision do in the law? The law, it is a way to prevent state party allocation rules from being frustrated. Now, I don't actually think DGA is a, as I expressed last time, really poses any risk there. But set that aside. Your point on the plain language of the statute, I get. But if you were going to look at just the plain language of the statute and say, look, let's not worry about what Congress meant. Let's not worry about what the intent is. Let's not worry about what might have been, what could have been, what should have been. And that's fine. And I wasn't trying to inject that. I was actually trying to respond to what I thought might be motivating some of this. But if you just look at what Congress wrote agents acting on behalf of and established finance, maintain, and control language very purposely. It just did. It is. I feel very comfortable. I have the better of the argument that Congress didn't accidentally not include it here. Like, I think they wrote it where they wrote it very purposely, where they wanted to count agents and count established finance, maintain, or control, and they just didn't write it in this section. And to say, well, they didn't write the opposite in this section, candidly, with all due respect, Madam Chair, I'm not sure how far that leads you. If you just take a neutral, if I asked you an exam book question without knowing whether it benefit or hurt, brought more money into the system, less money into the system, was good for parties, bad for parties, and I simply said it is a neutral question where you have a statute that is replete with a certain phrase except for one provision, how should we interpret the one provision? I think the better of the reading is probably that it doesn't apply there. But as the vice chair said, there are various Latin phrases for such things.
Commissioner Walker.
Thank you. I've got the same concerns, as you know, from the last go around, and I appreciate the footnote or proposed footnote, but it only really says that we. I don't think it really addressed the issue that we seem to be expressing concern about in the Office of General Counsel's as well, that in our own quote, we may not do through another what it cannot do directly, and that does appear to be structurally what was happening. And the footnote says we will have two separate and independent entities created, but that doesn't address the issue of either agency or alter ego. It does say that you'll have independent. Just because two organizations are formed doesn't mean one cannot be an alter ego of the other. That's an equitable remedy that occurs based upon, you know, the facts that you know, a given jurisdiction may want to use where they implement that equitable language. But are you saying that that Jobs can't act as an agent in this case?
Under what standard? A parent agency.
Well, I mean, you're using the word that the statute excluded, exclusio.
We have the Latin phrase.
I went to Notre Dame too. Yeah. you're making the argument that phrase is intentionally left out here, and therefore it can be used as that agency is permitted. And I mean, is that the point here that this can be an agent? And will be?
My point, and I don't mean to be non-responsive to the question, but having sat through and dealt with hours and hours of this commission's decision on agency. That is a very complicated topic. And it is one, if you want to identify which portion of the statute you mean, there's fundraising agency, there's McCain-Feingold agency, there's collecting agent agency. This commission has spent a lot of time on the concept of agency, and part of why I am loath and have thus far not taken several invitations from commissioners to assure the commission on agency is that then I didn't need an advisory opinion. I mean, honestly, then I get an FEC complaint over which standard of agency and whether it's fact specific. Then I have an advisory opinion that got me nothing. So the question is, if the commission deadlocks, then frankly, you need to issue a rule. You need to do a rulemaking because there is no rule. There is no agency in your rules. There's no agency in the statute for this provision. There's no agency in your rules for this provision. And the commission has struggled over time with agency in different contexts. So, Commissioner, if you want to specify for me which concept of agency you are asking me, we can start a dialogue about whether it would be agency under one of those standards. But draft B doesn't tell me which standard you're using for agency.
Well, generally, you can talk about an agent as being someone that will do they act on your behalf. And so generally, whoever acts on somebody's behalf at their direction in that is authorized to be an agent.
So only with actual?
Roughly.
So only with actual authority.
There's apparent agency, there's implied agency, actual agency, three types, true. But the argument being made here is that, that phraseology was excluded, and therefore, for some reason, the agency issue is removed from the table.
That's correct.
I just ask that, therefore, it's removed from the table. What kind of freedom does that give? I mean, absolute freedom to just act on one's behalf. I mean, this is structured for a reason. And the two officers are there for a reason. It's not just any old people that are going to run this thing.
They wish to engage in political activity in connection with state elections. And the question is whether the Federal Election Commission regulates that activity. I mean, that's at its core what the advisory opinion request asks, is if two individuals who work for an organization that seeks to elect governors, seek to set up an organization to affect elections of governors, and we give you assurances that we are not trying to engage in activity to affect the election of federal candidates, is that permissible under the statute as written? And I agree with the Vice Chair. I wasn't arguing McCain-Feingold's constitutionality or any of that. That's for the courts. I agree with you.
You're agreeing with the Vice Chair or the Chair at that point?
The Chair. You said that the courts decided. I'm not trying to unsettle anything that any court has said about this. It's the law is the law. What the courts say, good, bad, or indifferent. But I don't know how else to get at this question, because there isn't an agency provision in the statute and there's no agency provision in the reg, so I'm not sure I know what agency provision we would be importing, because this commission's had different agency provisions for different sections where there is statutory and regulatory authority.
I was thinking of seeing if you'd consider embellishing that footnote to some degree. I'm not necessarily inclined to give you the language, but something to the effect that it would not be engaging in any conduct that would be construed as acting as an alter ego for the other or as an agent for the other, period. Something like that.
Well,
throwing this out for discussion.
Yeah, yeah.
I'm not really saying yes, I'll do this.
Yeah, yeah.
No, I want that, but let's talk about it anyway.
So, Commissioner, you have stumped the band as we did last time on the alter ego. I thought, but you know more about alter ego law than I do. We went back and we looked at corporate law in D.C., and I thought what we cited was the relevant law that deals with alter ego / piercing the corporate veil. You may tell me that, in fact, we have misunderstood the alter ego piece of this equation, but I'd want to understand If it is not the law that we cited, I guess I'd want to understand what alter ego, what the, there is no federal alter ego law as far as I know, as I understand it, but again, you may tell me I'm wrong, it is a concept of state corporate law. And if there is some explication of it that we've missed, I'd be open to that. Agency, I have to say, is I don't see a statutory basis for importing agency here, and having at times asked this commission to do things that I thought made sense, but were not in the regs, and having been told often by this side of the dais that they may make sense, but they require rules. I think this is one of those places where I'm going to respectfully suggest that if there is going to be an agency concept, the commission probably needs to make a record of that through an administrative rulemaking process, if it can find the statutory.
There's policies. A lot of rulemakings we should be engaging in.
But on the alter ego, so I'm not
on top of our list.
Yeah. So on the alter ego, I'm not sure the answer is no, but I thought that was dealt with in the supplemental material we provided.
Well, you did point out. I mean, you have two separate entities. It doesn't mean that the very nature of alter ego means that there's two entities anyway. But it's just because you don't have a case right in point. You know, the doctrine's been out there for a long, long time, and it has general parameters that could fit here or may not. They're not really excluded by the language that is included, you know, that you did cite. I'm not saying, I think there probably is. You probably picked up all that there is maybe for D.C. I don't know.
I mean.
Yeah. And it's not incorrect, but it does set forth the same undercurrent of considerations. So I was just throwing that out for discussion. I'm willing to consider this, something along that line, and maybe want to think it over. And if you want a hard vote now, I would not be able to support it, but I'm trying to figure out a way to thread the needle a little bit.
Mr. Peterson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. If I could ask a question of my colleague, Commissioner Walther, just a little bit more about, I don't necessarily have a proposal, but kind of the parameters of what you're seeking here. Are you desiring that there be some language put in that footnote that would say they would not be acting as an agent, or what is it that you're that would give you comfort in this particular situation?
Well, I think I'd have more comfort along the lines that I mentioned if we were to say something like just pick up the language and say. And don't pick it up verbatim and say, okay, Mr. Walther, this is what you're going to do. But I'm suggesting that if we said, add a sentence and say, with respect to the activity covered by this, neither will act as an alter ego or agent of the other. I mean, that seems to help give some... comfort, if that's what we're calling comfort. Do you want to think over or experiment with the language? The magic words don't necessarily have to be in there, but
if alter ego is what's on the table, that's something I think we can look further at. Like I said, I thought that this was born of ignorance, not any effort to skew this. We discussed this last time, and my understanding is that piercing the corporate veil and alter ego are joined concepts, so that the law we cite, you are an alter ego when you are under the dominion control. In other words, the standard we set in that brief is the standard for alter ego, but I may be wrong about that. This is not at all my area of the law, and if your staff have ways to flesh out what alter ego, what is that means in D.C. law, that's, presumably we're looking at state law, that is something I'd be happy to continue to dialogue on. The agency concept, candidly, I have to say, honestly, I would rather the commission deadlock because you're never going to win an agency case. I mean, I don't mean that as a. You got to be careful telling your regulator what they'll win or not win. I don't even think you'll bring an agency case. It isn't in the statute, so I'm not going to sit here and agree to import agency from a provision isn't, because honestly, the non-federal world, the world of non-federal candidates, non-federal committees, they act as agents of each other all the time in connection with non-federal elections, and I assure you they don't have in mind the Federal Election Commission when they do so. So when the DGA works with the DLCC to run a program so that state legislators and state, you know, are they each other's agents? When one state candidate for mayor works with a state candidate for governor, are they acting as agents? That's just not a standard that, honestly, I want to be responsible for bringing in, because you're going to have an awful lot of mayors and state legislators and before you with FEC complaints citing that provision of an AO. So if we can do this without agency and we can do this with alter ego, I'm happy to keep looking.
Well, I mean, we have some basic language here that, you know, we've cited, you know, supported, has been part of the FEC common law, call it that, where it says courts will disregard the fiction of a separate legal entity when there is such a domination of finances, policy, and practices by the parent that the subsidiary has no separate existence on its own, is merely business conduit for its principal. We also then say, that was in Park Federal Savings Bank, we also say a entity may not do through another what it could do directly, what it could not do directly. That's Act Blue. So both alter ego and agency, I could see scary off, especially the use of the word agency, but you can see where we're headed here, and that's kind of...
So I think we actually have agreement on the first of those two, because the first of those two is actually, I believe, that standard of exercises such dominion or control. That language, I think that actually is taken from, because I think we cited that language back to the commission, I think that actually is taken from the piercing the corporate veil. I don't have language in front of me, the footnote we proposed I think actually says something that tracks that line of authority.
I think the footnote only points out that you form two separate entities. As I can tell.
Just to be helpful, since I have it in front of me, what your comment proposed was, the footnote could read, quote, this conclusion is premised on J&O remaining a separate legal entity from DGA under Washington, D.C. law. If J&O were found to not be a separate legal entity from DGA under Washington, D.C. law, J&O could no longer rely on this opinion.
Which I think is, if you read the rest of what we submitted in writing, what would cause them to be found not to be a separate legal entity would be the dominion control, you know, language. In other words, that's a conclusion based on D.C. law of when you are two separate entities, which is, I think, roughly equivalent to that language in the bank MER. Does that make sense?
Well, anyway, those are my concerns. I don't. I'm open to some expansion of that. Maybe that's worth talking about. I don't know how anxious you are for this decision.
But, you know, I'm always anxious.
We have a way of putting things over, as you will know.
I'm always anxious for a good decision before. Honestly, since I'm not going to probably be the one negotiating, right? It's going to be you all talking to each other. You should probably tell me whether it's, yeah. If I could convene a meeting and negotiate it out, but something tells me you probably want to move on to the rest of the agenda.
Be careful what you wish for.
There is that, Commissioner Under.
Commissioner Walther, does your expansion of the language include adding agency or not?
I was trying to see what, maybe that magic word doesn't have to be included. I just don't know. I haven't tried to figure out how to phrase that. But.
Some version of it. Even if that magic word agency is not in there, you want to bring the concept in.
Maybe agency is you know, for
That's probably not going to...
The stage is too broad in terms of you know, other kind of conduct as well. And I said with respect to the matter covered by this, as opposed to matters not covered by this. It's not of concern.
I think it's fair to say we'd be willing to discuss expanding, as you characterize it, the language of the footnote, if it only includes the concept of piercing the veil and that sort of thing. But to the extent it goes to agency or some version of it, that's probably not going to garner 4 votes.
Well, I'm open to discussing it.
I'm sorry?
I'm open to discussing it, see what we can come up with.
Without the agency?
Well, I'm not saying that language, the idea of control is, you know, a fundamental aspect of agency, but it's also part of the way they look at the alter ego concept. So.
But the alter ego is obviously a lot stronger than agency.
Why?
Because you're not just acting as an agent, you're really one and the same as the other entity. And what I think we're all willing to write around is you're not the same thing, but we're not willing to say you can't act as an agent because we think you can.
Well, I did ask that question, and the reason that I understood it is because of the concern that we have a lot of different agency definitions. I'm not so sure I agree with that. I think we have not what is agency, but how you get to agency, like implied agency and apparent agency. We've covered that in some regs. You know, apparent went out, implied went in. And I thought apparent should be in, but it didn't. It just was got implied. And so, I mean, we've threaded that needle before. But I was thinking of using different language, but I'm not going to try and divine exactly what that would work.
Okay. I think
if you,
any version
if you say
of
I can't
that,
talk about any aspect of it, then you know maybe it won't do it again.
Sorry.
If you say you're not going to talk any aspect about an aspect of agency, then I'm not sure we're going to get anywhere.
Okay. In the interest of promoting some kind of agreement, even if I'm not part of it, because I generally believe that 4 votes is generally preferable to fewer than 4 votes on an answer.
Amen.
I'm glad you agree with me on that.
The statute says for AOs. I mean, you don't get an AO unless there's...
No, that's right. That's right. But I, you know... never mind. Let me just inquire whether perhaps Commissioner Walther is thinking... or could be comfortable if the AO, if the footnote incorporated some of the language from the Park Federal Savings Bank conciliation agreement that talked about domination of finances, policy, and practices by the parent such that the subsidiary has no separate existence of its own and is merely a business conduit for its principal. And I don't know whether that would bring people together or not, but... I just, since people are sort of talking around.
I think we're getting close to that. I mean, I'm really talking about this particular aspect of its existence, not that you will now disregard that corporation from all other aspects of its conduct. So incorporating it in the broad sense is not what I'm really thinking of having to try and do. But, I tend to think we probably could figure something out, but... it might take a little bit of back and forth on how to do that. I don't think we should. I mean, I'm not inclined to try and do that today with everything else that's going on. But you know, it depends a little bit on where you. But if you need the vote today, then we probably just vote it up. But
Commissioner Peterson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm certainly open to. I'm always open to trying to figure out if there's a way we can thread a needle to find agreement where it's possible. And if there's some additional language on the alter ego element of this that that gives additional comfort, I think that there's probably some room for some further consideration of that. I would just reiterate what Commissioner Hunter said. I think the concept of trying to bring the concept of agency either directly or indirectly by trying to, you know, write around the word agency, but still other, but functionally bring it into this context, I wouldn't be comfortable with, because as I look at this provision, and as Mr. Elias has pointed out, Congress knew when and where to apply the concept of agency, and in fact, they do it in this exact paragraph. I mean, it starts off talking about amounts expended for federal election activity by state and local committees of political parties, and then parenthetically adds that that includes entities controlled by a state or local committee of a political party, and an officer or agent acting on behalf of such committee or entity. So it had, Congress had agency on the brain when it was drafting this. It's not like this was included and then there was some assumption that maybe agency would apply or not apply here. I mean, the concept of agency is directly included in this exact provision. And then it says it includes associations of candidates for state or local office, for state or local office, or of individuals holding state or local office. And there is no equivalent parenthetical put in there. I think that that's very relevant in this context. Congress put this together in one particular time. Like I said, it had agency on the brain, and it decided to put the parenthetical behind when referring to state and local committees of political parties, but didn't when discussing associations of candidates for state or local office. And that's, I mean, we really, I agree with Mr. Elias that if we were to go back go back 10 years to find out what Congress intended, I think that Congress didn't intend to include agency in this particular provision. But even setting that aside, the greatest example of what congressional intent is not from floor statements, it's not from, you know, committee reports, it's from the actual language that is voted by a majority of the congressional body and actually signed by the president. And that language, as it's before us, includes agency with respect to state and local parties and doesn't with respect to associations of candidates for state and local office. So I just don't see how we get around that. And that's the reason why I think this is an easy question on this particular issue. So again, I'm more than willing to, you know, if there's some additional language that can give us comfort on the alter ego theory, you know, in addition to what Mr. Elias helpfully provided, I'm certainly open to that. But I attempts to backdoor agency into this particular provision would, at least for me, would not be something I'd be willing to go along with, but I'm certainly willing to. Hopefully, maybe we can find some agreement on somewhere along the way on this particular AO.
Madam Chair, may I?
Mr. Elias, please.
And that's the reason why I appreciate how hard the commission has worked at this, and I don't want the commissioners or the staff to think anything other than that, because I really do. But I have to say that Commissioner Peterson, in a matter of 2 minutes, did a better job explaining this than I have done now over the course of what is probably several hours. And it is the reason why I have brought so much passion to this, because if you look at the provision, to me it's just not a close call. They put agency in one section and didn't put it in the other. And it's the reason why I am reticent for the future to put a concept of agency in this advisory opinion, because we are then at that point now importing a concept that specifically was left out. And when this commission did its rulemaking implementing this provision, the commission didn't put it in. So it seems like this is a very, very dicey place in an advisory opinion process to now say, well, Congress didn't put it in the statute, notwithstanding the way it's written, and the commission didn't put it in its implementing regulations, but here we are. So I appreciate what Commissioner Peterson said, and honestly, it is a better explanation than I think I've offered so far, and maybe a clearer sense of why I feel so strongly that this second question is such an easy one.
I agree with you, Mr. Elias, that Commissioner Peterson is very pithy, and his explanation was succinct and very informative. But it is a harder question for some of us than for others. I mean, I really, as I said, I would I think in general we are we do better. We do our job better when we try to find four votes for something rather than just kind of throwing up our hands and disagreeing. So it sounds like maybe people want to try to work on this a little bit longer. Commissioner Peterson?
If I could inquire of counsel, I'm assuming we're right up about the end of the 60-day deadline, so we'd obviously have to get an extension.
Yeah, the deadline is Monday.
What do you say then, Mr. Elias? You want to give us
if the commissioners believe that they are going to come to resolution or likely kind of come to resolution, then I will confirm during a break with my client, but I'm sure that's not going to be a problem. If on the other hand, you know, this is really a question for you all in the first instance to know whether you feel like more time would be useful. Last time you thought more time would be useful. If the commission feels more time is useful, then I'll ask the client. I'm sure they'll consent. But I don't want to say I think you should take more time. Do you understand what?
I hear you, Mr. Elias, and I regret that I thought that extra time would do it for us. It appears not to have. I don't want to make any promises to you and your client either. I mean, it sounds like maybe there's. Possibility.
Well, I think it was more useful than not. How's that?
Commissioner, yeah.
We may warm up to an agreement on this at some point. I can't say, but I mean, it sounds to me like we're getting close.
My question is to the chair. It sounds like you're not interested in.
I am probably further away from you than Commissioner Walther, but. I do find this to be a very difficult one, so I wouldn't say that I am irrevocably lost to the cause.
Okay. Well, if it's okay with Mr. Elias and his client, then we're happy to look at whatever proposal Commissioner Walther and the chair come up with.
If I can just confer. Good.
Sure.
I think the vice chair.
Mr. Vice Chair.
Thank you. Just the timing, though, is still troubling to me. When did you first file the request? I can't find it in my file.
The initial pre-AOR came in on June 12th.
June 12th.
And it was complete on June 25th.
Okay, so whether one looks at when it was first filed or when it was quote-unquote complete, that's 2 months already. We've had two meetings now. You're talking about gubernatorial elections. You have some of those in a few months.
We do indeed.
These folks that want to do this probably want to be relevant to that. The point is, we keep not wanting to do it today or, you know, not inclined to so do today. That are we going to call the registrar in New Jersey and say we're going to hold the election off for a few months? I'm being serious. I mean, this is people need guidance in real time, and you know, I appreciate trying to get a deal and all that, but at a certain point, we have to keep in mind that the world doesn't revolve around what we do here. There's an election that comes and goes whether or not we get it together, and at a certain point, we need to let these folks know one way or another. So can we do this? Can we be certain to get this at maybe the next meeting, or can we have some sort of end fish or cut bait date, because I don't think it's fair to a requester to sort of get in an open meeting and say, hey, can you give us an extension when you have an election, you know, date certain away, because that exposes us to, you know, people could criticize us for playing games on that front. I don't want that to happen, because right now the states that are in the hot seat for gubernatorial races are not the ones that are. Politics are weird, right? I mean, it's the Republicans here are the ones saying you can go do this, but yet on the gubernatorial ballot, it's the R's that are sort of the incumbent governors, you know. So it's backwards from the usual politics. But I just want to make sure no one thinks that the timing here is that it is all suspect on my part, but because it's not. But you have an election coming up, so can we at least commit to having this ready to go one way or another next time? Or maybe sooner than that, or what can we do here? Because this is taking way too long to begin with.
I think Mr. Elias is rightly looking back at us. Your question is not
I'd come back tomorrow. You tell me what timing is, and I'll like I said, I'll confirm it with my client. I don't even know candidly when you meet next.
I think it's September 12th. I believe that's our next open. Let me confer for a moment. Thank you. Let me propose this. I think the Vice Chairman raises certainly a pertinent point, and I recognize that the Vice Chairman was ready to vote last time and ready to vote today, but, you know, if we voted today, we wouldn't have four votes for anything. That's just the reality. And I think there's a possibility that we could come up with four votes. But I can't promise that. So let's ask for an extension till the next meeting at the latest. And if we can get a proposal that people agree on before then, we can always post it on the website as a draft, give you an opportunity to comment or anybody else who wants to comment on it, and schedule a tally vote if we think we'd be ready to go before that. I appreciate what the Vice Chairman said, but on the other hand, my sense is that Mr. Elias would, if there's a reasonable chance that he might get a yes instead of a split vote, that he'd probably prefer to get that, and his client as well.
I will. So the date we are asking until is
September 12th.
September 12th. Okay.
At the latest.
I'll just confirm that. And can I? We don't need to. I can just let your them know. I don't need to be here.
No. Not unless you want to be.
No. I feel like I've had enough.
You're always welcome.
Really?
Sure. All right, let's try that. So with that, we will hold this matter over, hopefully to definitively resolve it one way or another soon. Thank you, Mr. Elias, for your patience and your participation. The next item on the agenda is AO 2013-08 from the American Veterinary Medical Association. We have the late submitted documents on this. Commissioner Walther is recused on this AO. Let's see. Mr. Vice Chairman, we have late submitted documents.
Yes, we do. I move to suspend the rules on the timely submission of agenda documents in order to consider delayed submission of agenda document numbers 13-35A, 13-21L, and 13-37. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Everyone understand the motion? Any comments? All in favor say aye.
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 Motion passed. Oh, any opposed? Just in case. Okay. Motion passes 4-0. Ms. Buckley.
Thank you, Chair Weintraub. Good morning, Commissioners. Agenda documents 13-35 and 13-35A contain a draft advisory opinion that responds to a request submitted on behalf of the American Veterinary Medical Association. The draft in agenda document 13-35A is a revised version in both redlined and clean forms of the draft in agenda document 13-35, which takes into account comments submitted by the requester. HAVMA is a nonprofit membership organization incorporated under Illinois law. The American Veterinary Medical Association Political Action Committee is the separate segregated fund of HAVMA. HAVMA asks if it may solicit and accept contributions for HAVMA PAC from members of the Student American Veterinary Medical Association. The draft concludes that HAVMA may solicit and accept contributions from the members of SAVMA because they also qualify as members of HAVMA. The draft also concludes that HAVMA and SAVMA are affiliated organizations. The Commission received no comments on the request and the one previously mentioned comment on the initial draft. I am happy to answer any questions you may have.
Thank you, Mr. Buckley. And I believe we have Mr. Jones in the room with us. Feel free to take a seat because I think I'll have at least one question for you and perhaps others will as well.
Excuse me, Madam Chair. I just want to confirm that Dr. Hall is on as well. He's participating by phone.
Ah, well, welcome, Dr. Hall.
Dr. Hall, are you there? No.
Or maybe not.
Dr. Hall? Well, why don't you go ahead and proceed, and we'll try and get him on.
I think this will be relatively easy. I suspect Mr. Jones can answer my question, which is just, have you had a chance to review the amendments to the draft, which were based on your comment, and do they, is our draft now accurate and appropriately reflect the facts that you've conveyed to us?
Yes, I did have an opportunity to review that draft, and I appreciate the quick turnaround on that, and it does accurately reflect the factual circumstances.
Perfect. We like to be accurate. Mr. Vice Chairman.
I move we adopt agenda document number 13-35A, which is the revised draft you just referenced, which answers the question in the affirmative, I believe. It's a positive result for the requester.
Yes. Thank you, Mr. Vice Chairman. The Vice Chairman has moved approval of the draft advisory opinion 2013-08 as reflected in agenda document 13-35A and authorize any technical and conforming edits that are necessary. Is there any discussion on the motion? All in favor say aye.
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 Any opposed? Motion passes 4-0. Thank you, Mr. Jones.
Thank you.
Somebody summoned Commissioner Walther back. I don't know whether he thought we were going to be quite that efficient. The next item on the agenda is draft advisory opinion 2013-09, Special Operations Speaks PAC and Robert L. Manis. I suppose I should mention that we did have another advisory opinion on the agenda, but it was withdrawn, so that's why it's not there anymore. Oh, and I see Mr. Backer is in the room. Mr. Backer, why don't you come on down and sit at the table? And I suspect someone will have a question for you, and if not, it's always nice to see you.
Thank you. Nice to see you as well.
Some
That's quick. Okay, Commissioner Walther has rejoined us. Ms. Hemsley.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Commissioners, good morning. Agenda document 13-37 is a draft response to an advisory opinion request submitted by the Special Operations Speaks PAC and Robert L. Manis. SOS PAC is a non-connected hybrid political committee that's been registered with the commission since July of 2012. Additionally, it has received contributions from more than 50 persons and has made contributions to three federal candidates, including $2,600 to Colonel Manis, a candidate for U.S. Senate for Louisiana. The committee wishes to contribute an additional $2,400 to Colonel Manis, which would exceed the contribution limits for persons other than multi-candidate political committees. The requesters ask whether prior to making contributions to five federal candidates and qualifying for multi-candidate status, it may make, and the committee may make, and Colonel Manis may accept the additional contributions up to the higher limit for multi-candidate committees. The draft concludes the act prohibits SOS PAC from making and Colonel Manis from accepting from SOS contributions in excess of $2,600 before SOS gains multi-candidate status. We received two comments on the request and one comment on the draft. Thank you, Madam Chair. We'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Ms. Hemsley. Do we have any questions for counsel, questions for Mr. Becker, or any discussions on the draft? Mr. Vice Chairman.
I'll start us off. I read the request as putting before the commission a facial challenge to the act regarding one of the qualifications to be a multi-candidate PAC. I'm not sure how we can help on that. I've always found the PAC requirements to be somewhat odd and all that, but that's what Congress passed, and it's not really for me to decide whether or not they are how I would have drawn the line. It kind of is what it is. I pulled out Buckley, and I just want to state this, and maybe I'll give Mr. Becker a chance to react to what I'm going to say, but let me just say this. Let me quote Buckley. Section 608B2 permits certain committees designated as political committees to contribute up to $5,000 to any candidate with respect to any election for federal office. In order to qualify for the higher contribution ceiling, a group must have been registered with the commission as a political committee under 2 U.S.C. Section 433 for not less than 6 months, have received contributions from more than 50 persons, and except for state and local party organizations, have contributed to five or more candidates for federal office. Appellants argue that these qualifications unconstitutionally discriminate against ad hoc organizations in favor of established interest groups and impermissibly burden free association. The argument is without merit. Rather than undermining freedom of association, the basic provision enhances the opportunity of bona fide groups to participate in the election process, and the registration, contribution, and candidate conditions serve the permissible purpose of preventing individuals from evading the applicable contribution limitations by labeling themselves committees. This is Buckley, and for those who like pinpoint sites, it's at page 35 to 36. So there's that. Although the FEC is not in the caption, Vallejo was the Secretary of the Senate, the FEC was a party, so I don't see that we can just say, well, that, you know, the Buckley court wasn't really talking to the FEC in that. And it seems to be, to me, the same argument. Now, I certainly appreciate that times have changed and that certain aspects of the law have been struck, certain things have been put in doubt and all that. But that's all well and good to a certain point for commission adjudication, but it really doesn't work for what I see as a facial challenge to the act. That can either be fixed by Congress or by an Article III court, but not by an agency. Now, what an agency can do, and this has caused some confusion, and I think sometimes I read the comments that came in. I think that part of the confusion is the sense that, well, the commission does look at constitutional issues, and of course we do. We have to. There's case law, and this is something rather new in the world of the commission. I remember when I first got here, this idea that, well, we don't really worry about constitutional issues at all seemed to be the norm. But If you look at Arizona versus Intertribal Council of Arizona, the recent Supreme Court case, there the majority of the court said this, that is because we think that by analogy to the rule of statutory interpretation that avoids questionable constitutionality, validly conferred discretionary executive authority is properly exercised as the government has proposed to avoid serious constitutional doubt. Avoiding doubt is a different issue than saying the act is unconstitutional altogether. And we see this in Horn versus Department of Agriculture is another case, recent Supreme Court case from this year, where the question was whether it's a USDA case and whether somebody had to exhaust administrative remedy by including a takings constitutional argument. And the court said petitioners were therefore free to raise their takings-based defense before the USDA. And the court essentially says that the USDA, if they raise it, they could consider it. So to the extent an agency wants to avoid a constitutional issue by reading a statute narrowly to avoid it, that's certainly within an agency's discretion. And not only is it within the agency's discretion, at least post-Arizona versus Intertribal Council of Arizona, it looks like the Supreme Court says we have to do it. Validly conferred discretionary executive authority is properly exercised to avoid serious constitutional doubt. So if the agency doesn't avoid constitutional doubt, I would say that would be improperly exercised executive authority, putting the rest a longstanding issue at the commission. Then we have all that, which has really nothing to do with this request, as I read this request, because this request seems to say, I think this one is the five or more candidates. And I hear you that it seems that you only want to make three, you don't want to make five, and it's not fair because other people that have more money and have already been established and all this seem to have a little bit of an edge, and they can give more money than you can give. And that all makes sense on some level, but I'm looking at this language from Buckley, which seems to be the same argument that was raised before the court. Now, you know, the statute's been updated. You know, you maybe say, well, there's something different. But that's going to be my question. Why does this language at Buckley not decide the answer to this without much in the way of any sort of fanfare?
Well, with respect to Buckley's discussion of this, their concern comes down to circumvention. And when they talk about bona fide political groups, they're either talking about those that are not attempting to be circumvent the base limits or those that are somehow discriminating between people who really have a right to talk in politics and really don't. My reading of that is that when they say bona fide, they mean groups that were formed to be political groups and not attempt to circumvent the limits. And so the issue comes down to purely the question of circumvention. And as we outline in the AOR, we believe rather strongly that the question of circumvention was very well addressed by Congress after Buckley was ruled upon, and that simply because nobody's had the opportunity to challenge it doesn't make it any less defective as a constitutional justification. And absent circumvention as the justification, that provision simply cannot stand constitutional scrutiny.
Maybe you're right, maybe you're not, but I have a statute passed by Congress. I have a Supreme Court case talking about the same language. The language even talks about the idea of favoring some over others. And now you're saying, well, that this, in your case, the anti-circumvention rationale really doesn't apply because you're not really trying to circumvent anything. You just want the higher limit, and it just seems like you should get it. And you know, that's okay. Let's take that as true. I want to give $10,000 to a member of Congress, and I'm not at all trying to bribe him. There's no appearance of corruption in my mind, so I can give that member of Congress $10,000 as a campaign contribution. It seems to be your argument.
I'm not sure I follow. I think our argument is that this large aggregation of all these small dollar individual donors who share a particularized set of values and interests and want to get behind those candidates who share those values and are essentially required to become a political action committee if they want to support these candidates and these values outside of the PAC and or the political party and candidate regime, mm-hmm. They're required to be a PAC. And then they're being told, okay, you have to organize your grassroots speech, and we have to register you, and you have to be monitored, and you have to report. But we're not going to let you have all the same rights as some other groups of people that are doing this because they've been around longer and because they want to give to more people. They have a different set of they want to be more engaged. I think there is an I think the rationale only flies if it's a circumvention issue with respect to having this five-candidate limit, and I think the circumvention issue has been addressed. And
look, that could be. Supreme Court has laid out the 23 burdens that, mm-hmm. that attach to PAC status. Now you don't have the limit on independent PACs, so maybe you're down to 22 burdens. No one questions it's a very burdensome mm-hmm. thing. I've been arguing this for years. You've been arguing it for a lot shorter than I've been arguing it. But we're an agency with a statute, and the question is, what do you want me to do about any of this? I hear you. You think you have an argument. You don't think the government can provide a sufficiently strong interest under whatever level of tailoring a court says this would come under. It looks, even to me, like this is a contribution limit sort of analysis, not a spending limit analysis, but maybe I'm wrong on that. What do you want us to do about it? I mean, it's not really the FEC's job to get into whether we can justify what Congress passed in the first instance, particularly in light of the language of Buckley, right? I mean, isn't this a question really for the guys in the White Dome down the street to fix this?
It may well be, but I'm going to use a somewhat specious example here. But imagine the statute were written, FECA was written 100 years ago, and it contained language that would now be very clearly unconstitutional. For example, women may not contribute to political action committees. Obviously, if that were...
Did Congress take that out?
I'm pretty sure that's not in the statute
at the
moment.
There wasn't FECA 100 years ago.
But my point being...
FECA was like 70...
Right, but if there was a provision, I'm using a very, very obviously bad example in order to lay the foundation and narrow it down. But if there was such a provision, and it simply had never been enforced, but it was on the books,
right.
And it wouldn't be unreasonable to say, well, look, this provision's on the books. We don't want to risk violating this provision. It's obviously ridiculous. It's unconstitutional. Here's the court cases saying this is not an acceptable. This is discriminatory. And you would say, I would assume we would come here and you would say, yeah, of course, this is not enforceable. With FECA, you have a much younger provision of law, but I would argue that whatever justification there might have been for this particular provision at the time it was written, subsequent legislation and court activity have rendered it just as moot. It's just not.
Which legislation has rendered it moot?
The 76 amendments, which expanded the protections against circumvention.
But they didn't change this language in the 76 amendments. So they passed other language that rendered language moot that they didn't change?
I would say yes. That and maybe that's an oversight of Congress, but to have left it in. But or maybe, quite frankly, I'm of the belief that campaign finance laws are inherently pro-incumbent, and incumbents that are looking at the laws that they're writing to protect their own interests are going to pay a lot more attention to the laws that they care about than these smaller provisions that they might not realize are a problem. And to be fair, I don't think this provision was a problem 3-4 years ago. I think the explosion of grassroots political speech in the last 4 years or so has radically changed the level and the nature and the character of individual participation in politics. I don't think you had groups that would have faced this burden in 2006 or 2007. I think now, we may be one of the very first, but there's going to be more organizations that are focused behind very narrow sets of issues and want to be very focused on a narrow group of candidates, and they're going to start facing this burden. So it may be that this is a case of first impression, but I think this is a problem that is arising.
It's not first impression. People have had a problem with this rule for a long, long time. There's been grassroots groups before. They've been on both sides of the ideological spectrum, and to the extent it's not linear, it's circular, all around the ideological spectrum. And it's something that Congress put in to... I think Congress thought it was a good thing. You're going to get an enhanced limit if you band together and you can give a PAC check. I mean, they didn't index the PAC contribution limits. They probably should have, but they didn't. Even if I agree with everything you say about it being an incumbent protection system, I don't see what we can do other than say, well, the statute says you've got to give the five. You haven't given the five, so either go to the White Dome or go see a man in a black robe. I don't think I can say yes if I wanted to.
And that may very well be the case.
Okay.
But
I just want to make sure we're clear about that, that we're not, because if you come to the comments, the FEC can't justify this, the FEC can't justify that. Congress needs to justify their laws, not the FEC. Right? I mean, whether there's a governmental interest is for those who pass the laws to figure out what they were doing. And, it's rare for me to sort of say, well, I never like the steer clear or just, look, get with the program kind of rhetoric, because I really bristle at that in most instances. But I do note that the making five contributions, you don't have to make the maximum contribution. You can give a dollar to five candidates, and that satisfies that prong of you give one penny to five candidates, and that satisfies, and that doesn't even get itemized. That satisfies the five candidate part of the three-part multi-candidate test, right?
Yes, but then they would be associating in even a minuscule way with people they don't want to associate with.
And I think they can only find three candidates they want to associate with?
So far, yeah. And frankly, a lot of their effort and work is much more focused on independent speech than it is on candidates. But when they want to get behind a candidate, they want to get behind a candidate in a big way.
And the individual limit, which is the non-multi-candidate PAC limit today, is?
$2,600 per candidate
per election. Right, and the PAC limit is five.
$5,000.
So you're looking at $2,400 difference.
Yes.
Want to get behind them in a big way, another $2,400.
We want to get behind them with every conceivable ounce of strength that we're able to get behind them, would be my client's perspective. They're very strong believers that, if you're on somebody's team, you're on their team. And they deploy the resources to the maximum extent possible when they can. And I think to them, the argument that, well, it's only $2,400, the response is, yeah, but, IBM PAC can give them $5,000. The Teamsters can give it $5,000. Why is our speech, not as valuable as IBM or the Teamsters?
Same issue brought to the Supreme Court in Buckley. Mm-hmm. And the Supreme Court said the argument's without merit. Right or wrong, that's what he said. And at least since Marbury versus Madison, that's the final word, unless Congress tries again with a different statute, and they haven't done that.
I would suggest the Supreme Court said it's without merit in the context of the circumvention problem that they were addressing, which is since I would argue has since been cured. Obviously, that's that's my perspective. Reasonable minds will differ on this, and we do get that we're coming here asking for a remedy that the Commission may not be able to give us. But we do think it's incumbent on the Commission to at least assess the constitutionality of the provision. Because, again, if it were an absurd provision like, women may not contribute to political action committees, that obviously you would sit here and say, well, look, here's why this is or is not, why what we can do about it and why it's a problem.
That's different, though. And I don't want to belabor the point because I think we all know where we're going to end up, I think. It's a difference between avoiding constitutional doubt and a frontal attack on the face – a facial attack on the statute, right? And you're hypothetical about the statute. The law says women can't give. Well, there's a mountain of case law that says that's just not going to work, and you're going to avoid reading the statute in a way that's going to crash into the rocks of the mountain of equal protection case law. That's not the same thing at all from what you have here. It's not just a difference of degree. It's a whole different kind of example. And I just, even if I agree with you, nothing I can do about it. I certainly, as you know, I've written about it quite extensively. When it comes to considering constitutional issues and taking case law seriously, I'll put my record up against anyone's. But in this case, that's not what this is. And if you think it does, it burden that. That's a nice test case, and you're going to have to explain to a judge, I think, that. Times have changed, and in your particular case, this is just not serving the purpose that the Congress has articulated for the purpose of the multi-PAC thing. And I wish you Godspeed in that endeavor, but I can't. We can't. That's not what the FEC does. With respect to this, you're not giving me a lot to work with here. Is my point. So I'll yield back, and at the appropriate time, I would like to move agenda document number 13-37. At the appropriate time, could be right now or not, but I don't want to, short-circuit any robust discussion anyone wants to have.
Are there any further comments or questions? Mr. Backer, once again, I think you're in the wrong building.
Happens quite a bit, but at least I get to bring unanimity to the commission, so that's always
not
nice.
Not that it isn't always a pleasure to see you. Something that you said before suggested that maybe these multi-candidate committee requirements have been moot since 1976. I think that would surprise a lot of people. It seems kind of unlikely to me. But in any event, I think the vice chairman's right. This is a facial challenge. You want to bring a facial challenge, you got to go to court. So I plan to support the draft. If there are no further comments, The Vice Chairman has moved approval of Draft Advisory Opinion 2013-09, as set forth in Agenda Document 13-37, with any appropriate technical and conforming amendments. Any discussion on the motion? All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Any opposed? Motion passes 5-0.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Backer. The next item on the agenda is going to audit land now. Audit Division Recommendation Memorandum on the Arizona Republican Party, A11-21.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Hatch, are you going to speak for us?
How are you, sir?
This one over here.
Are either of those
good morning, Commissioners. Before you is the Audit Division Recommendation Memorandum on the Audit of the Arizona Republican Party. The audit resulted in three findings. The first finding, a comparison of the committee's reported financial activity with its bank records revealed a misstatement of the beginning and ending cash balances, receipts, and disbursements for calendar years 2009 and 2010. In response to the interim audit report, the committee filed amendments that materially corrected these misstatements. The audit staff recommends that the commission find that the committee misstated their financial activity for calendar years 2009 and 2010. The second finding, the committee reported coordinated expenditures for three House candidates that exceeded the 2010 coordinated party expenditure limit by a total of $383,862. In response to the interim audit report, the committee provided a written description of tasks performed by volunteers and other documentation to show that the expenditures were not actually coordinated but qualified for the volunteer materials exemption and were not properly disclosed on its original reports. Given the uncertainty regarding the level of volunteer involvement needed to qualify for the volunteer material exemption, the draft final audit report did not attribute these expenditures to the committee's coordinated expenditure limit. The audit staff recommends that the commission find that the reported expenditures of $383,862 should not be attributed to the committee's coordinated expenditure limit. The final finding was the committee failed to report debts and obligations for seven vendors totaling $81,948 on their Schedule D debts and obligations. In response to the interim audit report, the committee filed amendments to include these debts and obligations. The audit staff recommends that the commission find that the committee failed to report debts and obligations totaling $81,948. We are prepared to answer any question that you may have on these issues. Thank you.
Thank you. Does anyone have any questions for the auditors or the lawyers or any discussion on the recommendation memorandum? Mr. Vice Chairman?
I think I approved it on paper.
I think you did.
Yeah, so I'm cool.
We're always happy when you're cool. For me, I think there's a small fine point in finding two. With respect to the volunteer materials exemption, I just want to make sure that we are treating this committee in the same way that we have treated other committees. And while this may not make a big difference to too many people, I think having the reports be consistent is something we ought to strive for. There were three mailers that were involved here, and staff will correct me if I'm wrong on any of the facts, but as I understand it, with respect to the Schweikert mailer, we had some evidence of volunteer activity. And with respect to the Gosser and Kelly mailers, there was actually no documentation that the committee was able to come up with.
During audit field work, they did provide photographic documentation for the Schweikert mailers of volunteers working at the mail house preparing the mailers for delivery to the post office for mailing. There were no other
documentation provided for the other committees, and then in response to the interim audit report is when they provided a written statement as to what tasks the volunteers on all the mailers performed.
But they didn't have any, they had no affidavits, they had no pictures, they had.
They did not. They requested it from the candidate committees, but they received nothing. They also reached out to prior staff of the state party committee for statements and affidavits, and so far we have not received anything. This particular state party, it's almost every election cycle, there are new individuals involved with the day-to-day operations of the committee.
And they are not unique in that regard. So it seems to me that the Schweikert mailer, where there was they had some photographs, the preparation of that, and the information that we have in front of us is quite analogous to the Democratic Executive Committee of Florida audit, where they also came up with some photographic documentation, and in that case we used that precise language that I think the auditors have recommended on how this would not be attributed to the coordinated expenditure limit due to the lack of clarity on the volunteer materials exemption. With respect to the Gosser and Kelly mailers, where there's no documentation whatsoever, this is more like the mailer in the Washington State Democratic Central Committee audit, where we move that discussion to additional issues. So just for the sake of consistency, I think we should probably split out the mailers and treat them. I mean, the bottom line is not going to change for the committee, but the report will be consistent with our previous reports. Mr. Vice Chairman.
To adopt an audit report, we got to have four, so, you know, if that's what you want to do, that's what we're going to do, so. Don't split it out. I guess we split it out. Question I have, though, in this, what documentation is required under the statute or the reg with respect to volunteer mail?
Well, the statute itself is it just states that there has to be some type of significant volunteer involvement. Right. What we see out in the field on various audits.
Not what I'm asking. I'm asking what's in the statute or reg. There is no document required in the statute or reg, correct?
No. Right. You're right.
Okay.
That's true, but. You know, their auditors look for paper. That's the only way they can do an audit. And we have in the past accepted affidavits, you know, when people were in a position to provide affidavits.
But that's not, it's not the only way to do an audit. I mean, they do, you preempted me a little bit, the affidavit, but the audits do rely on what the auditor committee tells you time and time again. It's not only what's on paper. And in this case, there is no required paper trail for volunteer mail. It really has been for years what the committee says they did vis-a-vis volunteers in each mail piece or taking it to the post office or stamping and dish or whatever it is they do. They do it a variety of ways, but there is no actual list of things they have to do to do it or to you know, quote unquote qualify for it. That's my point, is that it still can try to make it consistent or inconsistent with whatever prior audit report we want, but the fact is the commission's never really listed this for you guys to, you don't have a commission approved checklist to say, well, we want to see, you know, the reg says you have to have pictures, or the reg says you have to have a log, or the reg says you have to get on the truck and take it to the post office and you have to sign. None of that's in the law. That's all kind of, well, I don't think there is federal common law at the FEC, but sort of in a sort of this amorphous kind of, you know, we'll call it audit common law. I mean, it's just not there, you know, and some of us have tried to get a little more clarity, but so far we don't have it. So I think you're right. I think your original report, the way you phrased it, was right, that it's not clear. You guys could use a little more clarity as to what you're looking for, and I think, you know, I'm fine with the report as is, but if not everyone is fine with it, then we have to move and, I guess, move certain parts to other issues. So I guess the one mail piece is okay. That's sufficient volunteer because they had pictures. And then the other, we don't have stuff, so that's going to, I just want to make sure I understand where
just
the
trying
next
to,
step is.
be consistent with what we've done in prior audits. In prior audits, when there's been some documentation, the pictures or, you know, I mean, usually, you know, we usually get the pictures of the happy volunteers sitting and stuffing the envelopes. That's usually what people do for us. And, you know, or provide an affidavit or something, you know, an affidavit from somebody who was there saying, well, we didn't take pictures, but trust us, there really were happy volunteers and we're willing to say so under oath. But in any event, I'm just trying to be consistent with what we've done in the past. So where there has been some form of documentation in the past, given that we have not been able to formulate more clarity, which I think is frustrating for all of us, the language in the report has stated that we would not attribute the expenses associated with that mailer to the coordinated expenditure limit due to the lack of clarity on the volunteer materials exemption, where there has been, and then there was the one case out of Washington where there was no documentation whatsoever, which I think is more analogous to the Gosar and Kelly mailers. And in that case, we just moved it all to additional issues, which is what we do where we don't agree. So that's just where it ends up in the report, just a question of where it gets placed in the report. But there's not going to be a, it's not going to affect the, as a result of moving this language around, there's not going to be a finding that they violated the law in any way.
I understand. Thank you. Can I just want one more question for the auditors?
Mr. Vice Chair.
Chair said that, you know, we usually see pictures, you know, the happy volunteers, that sort of thing. Now, I guess I'll direct this to Mr. Bonowitz. You're one of our more, probably the most experienced auditor we have. You've been doing this a long time. You've done a lot of audits. You've probably done a lot of state party audits. Is it true that you usually get pictures in your experience? I thought it's a more recent phenomenon, quite rare, but but you're the one been doing nitty-gritty of audits much longer than everyone else here. So is this, yes, is this common that there's pictures?
As this issue has come up more recently, photos are generally what we get along with a written statement from or affidavits from participants describing the duties everybody took place in. So
that's usually the recent, right? This doesn't go back 10, 20, 30 years of people giving pictures. This pictures is kind of a new post Democratic Party audit, I think, was the one first one with the pictures.
If I had to speculate on a time frame, I'd probably agree with you. It's more recent than when I first came on board.
Just seeing how things are evolving out there in the field.
I mean, there are general record-keeping requirements in the regulations, and that was just based on my own impression that the audits that I've seen recently, you know, we tend to get the pictures of the happy volunteers stuffing envelopes. With that, I don't think there's any disagreement with respect to findings 1 and 3. Someone wants to move. Commissioner Walther.
We talked about how to proceed. I'll go ahead and move 1 and 3, and then if there wants to be a motion on the other one, we could do that. But let me just start on this. In A1121, Arizona Republican Party, I move approval of the recommendations in the Audit Division Recommendation Memorandum on Arizona Republican Party with respect to findings 1 and 3.
Commissioner Walther's moved approval of findings 1 and 3 in the A11-21 Arizona Republican Party Audit Division Recommendation Memorandum. Is there any discussion on the motion? All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Any opposed? Motion passes 5-0. If you want to move approval of finding 2 as is, that would be fine.
Do we
and then I could follow up with a bifurcated one.
Well, it will. If you move approval of finding 2 and that fails, and then Commissioner Walther moves approval of finding 2 with respect to the Schweikert mailer, then by default, the Gosar and the Kelly mailers will end up in additional issues.
And I move without finding 2.
Thank you, Mr. Vice Chairman. The Vice Chairman has moved approval of finding 2 in the Arizona Republican Party Audit Division Recommendation Memorandum, A11-21. Is there any discussion on the motion? All in favor say aye. Aye.
Aye.
No, sorry.
Motion carries.
No.
Take it back. I'd like to have four, Madam
Chair.
We've had this discussion here all day about the
four votes. It's lunchtime. My blood sugar is low. Sorry. I take it back.
Just got in the spirit of togetherness.
Yes, I was. I was in the groove. Sorry about that.
So close.
Let me try that again.
So close. Yes.
So close.
Let me try that again. Let me call that question again.
In Arizona, the meeting hasn't even begun because it's 9 o'clock there, so it's not even...
They'll catch up
later. Yeah, we're West Coast. We'll get ahead of them.
We're East Coast, they're West Coast. On approval of finding 2, let me call the question again. All in favor say aye.
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 Any opposed?
No.
No? Okay. Motion fails 3-2. Sorry about that. With the Vice Chairman, Commissioners Hunter and Peterson voting in favor, Commissioner Walther and me voting against for the motions. Commissioner Walther.
I'll take over here. In A1121, Arizona Republican Party, with respect to finding 2, I move that only the reported expenditures of $160,532, the amount associated with Schweikert for Congress mailer, should not be attributed to ARP's coordinated expenditure limit due to lack of clarity on the volunteer materials exemption. I make that motion, but I still have concerns over whether we ever ought to say it's so unclear that we can't enforce aspects of our regulation, but that's my motion. I just had to say that.
Thank you. Commissioner Walther has moved approval of that section of finding 2, that the reported expenditures associated with the Schweikert for Congress mailer not be attributed to the ARP's coordinated expenditure limit due to the lack of clarity on the volunteer materials exemption, which is the same language that we've been using on a number of these audits where this issue has come up. Mr. Vice Chairman.
Just clarify the motion, because I think the gentleman used the word only, that we're going to approve only the part, and I don't think that's the intent of the motion, because if we emphasize only, that means I can't support the motion, because I think the rest of the report as is fine. So the way the chair has characterized the motion, I think, is probably the intent. I just want to clarify.
Let's delete that word only.
If I say I'm saying I not to.
Got it.
I got it. Okay.
But let's figure the only is deleted from the motion.
Okay. Thank you.
Commissioner Walther has amended his motion to delete the word only. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Any opposed? Motion carries 5-0. And since that motion did not include the amounts associated with Paul Gosser for Congress mailer and the Kelly for Congress mailer, audit will, in the normal course under Directive 70, move that discussion to additional issues. I think that concludes this matter. We have any other findings or issues that we haven't addressed? Okay. Thank you, gentlemen.
Thank you.
Next, we have the Audit Division Recommendation Memorandum on the Mississippi Democratic Party PAC, A11-10.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Good afternoon, all.
Welcome, and enlighten us, please.
Madam Chair, I am prepared to make an opening presentation, or we can move into any questions you may have.
Do you have a brief opening presentation?
I think it's brief.
Okay, let's go.
Before you is the Audit Division Recommendation Memorandum on Mississippi Democratic Party PAC, which addresses the 4 findings presented in the draft final audit report. For the first finding, misstatement of financial activity, the committee has amended its reports to correct the misstatements. The audit staff recommends that the commission find that the committee misstated their financial activity for calendar years 2009 and 2010. For the second finding, disclosure of disbursements, the committee has amended its reports to correct the missing payee information. The audit staff recommends that the commission find that the committee omitted information related to disbursements totaling $361,109. For the third finding, disclosure of occupation name of employer, the committee has amended its reports to correct the disclosure of the missing occupation and or name of employer information. The audit staff recommends that the commission find that the committee failed to report information related to occupation name of employer totaling $17,426. For the fourth finding, record keeping for employees, The DFAR notes that the committee did not maintain monthly logs to document the percentage of time each employee spent on federal election activity. The committee has implemented a plan to track employees' time spent on federal election activities. The audit staff recommends that the commission find that the committee failed to maintain logs to document the time employees spent on federal election activity totaling $138,741. Thank you, and we are prepared to answer any questions you may have.
Do we have any questions or discussion? It's my understanding that when we get the, the next stage, the draft, no, the proposed no, final audit yes. report, we will have the same language about the monthly logs for committees that, for employees who are being paid for with 100% federal funds that we have used in prior audits. Is that correct?
That's correct.
Okay.
What was that again? I apologize.
Commissioner Walden. Sorry?
What were you clarifying? I was trying to read something. I missed
there, in the draft final audit report that was presented to us, there were a couple of places where the language just needs to be tweaked to line it up with the previous audits where we've considered this question of staff who are being paid for with 100% federal funds, and the commission has said, well, that's if they're being paid for with 100% federal funds, we're not going to pursue anybody for not keeping the logs for those employees because they're paying for them with federal funds, and the whole purpose of the logs is to document whether they need to be paying for them with federal funds. So they're kind of reaching the conclusion without doing maintaining the logs. And as I said, we would be then consistent with previous audits on that point. Commissioner
Walker. We have been inconsistent with my vote, so just for the record, I will probably object for the record, especially since there's four votes already on this. I'm not sure if there were not four votes, I'd feel the same way, but I think I'll just maintain my position that I think even though it's all federal funds, I think records should be kept. People can change their mind midstream, and then what do you do? So I think really the record-keeping requirement is clear. We got to stick with it.
Well, of course, I haven't called the vote yet, but I think we're going to have four votes for this. Hate to predict things before they happen. Any further comments, or do we have a motion? Mr. Vice Chairman.
Given that we're going to have some tweaking of the language that we had all saw on the issue you raised, Madam Chair, I'm going to move agenda document number 13-34 with the understanding that that's going to get part of the cleanup of the document. We have to authorize staff to make technical conforming edits and including edits that they and the commissioners have suggested. I'll make that part of the motion just so it's clear that there'll be room to rewrite a little bit.
Thank you. The Vice Chairman has moved approval of agenda document number 13-34 with the understanding that when the proposed final audit report is prepared, it will incorporate the changes discussed at the table and any other technical and conforming edits that are required.